And now another no-brainer money-saving tip from Progressive.
That doesn't sound good.
Paper shredder's jammed, but I think I fixed it.
Oh, well, try shredding these $50 bills then.
Seems like it's working.
Better try another $400.
Stop. Instead of using money, use regular paper. And here's a better tip from Progressive on how not to waste money. Don't pay too much for car insurance. Drivers who switch and save could save hundreds. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. Potential savings will vary.
This is the Agile Uprising Podcast.
Okay, one more episode of the Agile Uprising Podcast. Today we are lucky enough to be joined by Ari Van Bennekom. I'm your host today, Ryan Lockard, with Andy Kleff from the Agile Uprising. Ari, how are you doing today?
I'm totally... It was a very busy day, to be very honest. I think with you it's still sort of early in the day. Over here we're approaching the end of the working day, and it was a very, very busy day with interviews and talks and partner negotiations and so on.
Well, hopefully this one will be a little more natural, and I don't have to pry on your brain cells too hard.
We can unwind a little bit. We promised one of the prerequisites for most of our Agile Uprising board meetings was that we had good craft beer. So if you feel thirsty, Ari, it's a little early, I think, for Ryan and I to crack one open. But given that it's Monday, maybe not.
Yeah.
No, so, Monday, actually, that's funny that you said, it's actually always my non-alcoholic day. Other days can be as well, but Monday is non-alcoholic anyway. Mm. So I'll just take a water if that's okay with you.
Perfect. Yes, that's fine. Put a lime or a lemon in it.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
All right. So to get started, I think we've done a few of these just to give you some context. We've done interviews with Alistair, with John Kern, recently with Bob Martin, and we have a few others lined up. So we're asking a similar bank of questions to everyone. And the general theme is we want to step through pre-Salt Lake, at Salt Lake, and then post-Salt Lake type format. And setting the stage, right? I'm not familiar with you and your background. Before 2001, can you just kind of give us a five-minute summary of who you were, what you were doing, and what your professional context was?
Yeah, I can. Writing the manifesto in 2001, I was at the age of 37, and I got into the world of IT in 1987, so 40 years earlier. And before this, and this has become, in perceiving Agile, it has become very important for me. I've been actively involved in the military forces and in the healthcare. And I have experienced situations in operating rooms, and also I've never been in active duty in war sites. It was the Dutch military forces, but still I have identified in those areas working with teams where you have, as a team, a shared focus where you all work on. And in the team, you have highly skilled and very disciplined people who know their craftsmanship. Then agility comes in, and when you go into an operating room, one objective that we all share, you know, to have mother and baby alive, safe and sound at the end of the operation, for example. People can step in for each other. Not everyone can step in for everyone, but people can step in for others. So we have not the single tasking, but we have the multidisciplined team way of working and getting things done. That's where I started, and I was perceived different already in the military forces. Then I got into the IT, and in 1994, I was doing waterfall projects, and I constantly said to my manager that I was working with at that time, whatever I'm going to do, this is what I don't want anymore. And I was doing a real traditional waterfall project at that moment. I said, this is what I just don't want to do anymore. And then I got into the world of rapid application development. What happened is that I, you know, started being actively involved in the communities of rapid application development. So with a colleague of mine in 1997, I got actively involved in the DSDM consortium, with the DSDM method as the intellectual property. We got the evolution more and more on DSDM as well. So we got to version 4, 4.1, 4.2, 5, and so on. Got involved in that. I was in the DSDM community actively involved in international projects that we did together. So we wrote parts of the manifesto. We created all sort of stuff, certification programs and stuff, also always for the community. And because of this, I got a call just before the weekend asking me if I could travel on the Saturday to Salt Lake City. Hmm. So I've been in my life. I started in the healthcare, went to the military forces, got into the IT, did a lot of wonderful stuff, development in there, was unhappy, and I changed my life into a new way of working. Rapid application development, then you start innovating, then you get into DSDM, and then actively involved in the community with Leech to writing the manifesto.
Yeah. I love that story, and I love the precursor to DSDM, where in the, you know, in the venue of the operating room, where you were already looking as teamwork, right, with multidisciplinary teams that someone could swap in and swap out. That sounds so progressive. Was it well before its time, or was that kind of discipline well established back in pre-2000?
Well, it's a discipline that I saw because I was a junior when I started in the healthcare, right? I did it a couple of years and then I stopped. And the thing is, if you look in hindsight, this is what I did. And we all know that if you want to look at a professional domain where hierarchy is still very much involved, it's in the worlds of medicine. You know, doctors are perceived, you know, the highest status, and the nurses are going down, and so on. So there's, on one hand, with the actual agile world today, there's a contradiction with hierarchy, non-hierarchy, and self-organizing teams. On the other hand, is once you go into an operating room and you have 10 people, you know, where a lady is giving birth to a baby, it's not going well, so you run down the hallway into the operating room, 5 people around the bed, you got into the operating room, there's a team waiting, you know, to have everything in place for the operation. And you have highly skilled, very disciplined people, and you see it happen. You know, yeah. People step back, others step in, and that's my perception. Same thing with the military forces, by the way.
Yeah. It's beautiful. So with the rapid application development, DSDM, prior to the manifesto, how were you propagating that discipline? How were you spreading the word? How did you get to be internationally known?
Well, I have to be very honest that the importance of discipline and very consciously taking things from individual tasking into teamwork has been not something that I flipped to overnight. It has been an evolving process. What I know is that I started doing, if you look at, you know, the word agile transformations, what I do at the moment, we do international transformations with my people. I think the first, what you can call a transformation at that time, was in 1998, 1999, you know, that time, big banks, financial, were trying to do on a corporate level global transformations. And I wasn't traveling that much at the time, but we were involved here working with the VIPs of the bank to make that happen. I was doing publications. I was trying to remember that at that time, and still I'm innovating, I'm working, I have my integrated agile transformation model, that's trademarked, but it's a framework and I innovate every single day on it, and every week. But at that time, I would come home and say, okay, tomorrow I have, you know, this workshop, what I'm going to do, and how am I going to do, what is going to work well. I just didn't know, you know, this is the best practice way of working. So figuring out, sitting on the couch back home, you know, with a snack and a beer, trying to, okay, what am I going to do? How am I going to do this? And then sharing that knowledge with others. So being actively involved in the community has been very important, making publications, already that time interviews, writing articles in the professional magazines and other kind of stuff.
Was the consortium the main catalyst for communication, or were you going through different channels?
Different channels. Yes, the consortium was really helping me in the sense that, you know, they have, you know, this was a community that of people who are really interested, but also we all know that then there's this magazine that says, oh, you're doing something in this community. Do you want to publish about this? And then someone said, oh, that's a nice, you know, nice article. You want to publish something for us too about this topic? And then, yeah, we do so. And then it's just growing. It's like a growing snowball. It's becoming more, more, more.
Hmm.
And when you talk about, you know, getting known and famous,
yeah,
we all know that in, you know, from the authors in the Agile Manifesto, most likely I'm one of the most unknown people, because 17 people, 16 in the US, one on continental Europe.
Hmm.
Yeah.
Ari, do you remember who called you or who reached out?
Yeah, I do. And actually, I was a couple of weeks ago at the Agile Business Conference in London talking with her about this. The DSDM Consortium started, I think, early 1995 with the publication of DSDM 1.0. And I got involved in 1997, and instantly I got into the community doing international work for the consortium. You know, this is the unpaid work, right? Non-paid. And the lady in charge of the back office at that time, Mary Hansen, she gave me the call in 2001, just, you know, to go to Snowbird. And today, she is from the Agile Business Consortium in the UK, which is, you know, the next step of the DSDM Consortium. She is the CEO. And she was actually, because 3 weeks ago, we were in London at the Agile Business Conference, and they introduced the name switch and the profile switch from DSDM Consortium to Agile Business Consortium. And she wanted me to be there because we have this bond, and she showed my face on screen while she was introducing the new organization. So we're still close together, yeah. I meet her a couple of times a year, always.
You said you got that phone call on a Friday, right?
No, it was a Thursday. And the funny thing is, it was Thursday, 18:20, being almost home. I got the call and I said, well, most likely I can do it. I was flying to London up and down the next day. I said, we can figure this out tomorrow, but I have to check with my wife first. So I got home 5 minutes later. And I said to my wife, you know, Seth, tomorrow I'm going to London, but is it fine with you? I fly to the US Saturday. She said, you know, that's fine. So I gave Mary a call. I said, Mary, no, Saturday morning, I'll be there. And then on Wednesday, I came back. Tuesday, I think it was Tuesday, I came back, Schiphol Airport. I did a lecture at the Amsterdam University, totally jet-lagged. And then I got home, and just before home, approximately at the same position close to my home, I gave my wife a call. I said, I'm on my way, I'm almost there. And she said, okay. And then she ran out into the street, because it turned out that in that weekend that we wrote the Agile Manifesto, half my house burned down. So there were all guys fixing my house when I came in. I was totally jet lagged, and I saw all these construction guys walking in and out of my house. Beep is happening here. And also, she decided to divorce me. So if you talk about life-changing weekends, that was one.
I was going to say, hopefully that wasn't ominous or anything, but maybe it was, just not related to Agile.
Yeah, it was.
Holy crap, that is a blockbuster weekend. I was going to reset some context here. Well, you say that you're one of the not well-known of the 17. I would argue, I think I talk more about you than most of the others when I'm publicly speaking, simply because you did bring in, you represented an entire continent, and you represented DSDM, and you were the only one that was invited from outside the U.S., yeah, or at least North America. So I think there is a lot to be put behind you in that statement. Yeah, and I also find it interesting that somebody that I respect as much as you still has to go through the wife level authority approval that I do personally when I have to book travel. So glad to hear not much changes as you move up the ladder, sir.
Well, the thing is, if I look in hindsight, I came back from Snowbird, and the same week we had a consortium board meeting. I was chairing that board at the time, and one of the guys we met, he said to me, you know, Ari, you just came in. You said, oh yeah, we wrote the manifesto last weekend. He said, you sat down and you opened the session, right? It was, we didn't realize what was happening. At the same time, I also remember that writing the manifesto, the other guys perceived DSDM as pretty heavy.
Mm.
And it didn't get a lot of attention, especially in the US. But I always work with project teams of 20 to 30 people. So, you know, scaling Agile is for me a non-issue, because it's the way I've done it always, also on the corporate level. And I remember that, I think it was Scott Ambler who said in Berlin, in Potsdam, some time ago, a couple of years ago when I was there was no full delivery method when the manifesto was written. Hell yeah, there was. DSDM, full delivery, including the business change. But at the same time, if you work just on teams, you know, people perceive it, oh, that's big. Yeah, but, you know, if you want to do real big minimum viable products that you sometimes have, you need to have projects. And now we have, of course, the books of, you know, projects in Agile and projects on Scrum or, you know, that kind of publication. Mm-hmm. But at the same time, projects in Agile, 1995, we're doing it in a whole community in Europe. So there's a whole community behind it. Yeah, sorry, there's a whole community behind it doing this.
Yeah, I think you covered a lot of topics that I really wanted to get into. But if we could, let's step back to 2001. You get off the plane. You go to Snowbird. Can you just set your mind's eye back to that room, the first couple minutes of the event kicking off on the first day, and just describe what you see and what you feel and, you know, your emotions in that room when it first started to kick off? And
well, I have to be very honest. I'm going to tell you my perception of things, and I heard other perceptions, so maybe my mind is blurred. I don't know. But let me tell you how, because it didn't start in the morning. It started the night before when we met. Dane Faulkner had organized the session, had created the facilities, because I think he owned at the time, or maybe still does, an apartment at Snowbird. He was involved in the DSDM Consortium North America at the time he got me in. Right, so we had the talk, beers, drinks. Great. Then the next day, one of the things that I know is we started explaining to each other, okay, so what's your intellectual property? What is it that, because we all been working differently for years. I started in 1994. Most of us, most likely somewhere in the mid 90s or earlier or later, I don't know exactly. I think Scrum dates 1995, XP from 1998 or 1999, I don't know. So we all had a reason why we worked in a different way, right? And so we started to explain how we worked, and this is the part that I really like, because normally when you have 17 guys in a room, everyone tries to explain to the other 16 that his idea is best. And to be very honest, I cannot recall it exactly, and I think we have played with that thought, and we try to convince others that, hey, what I do is awesome and it works. But at the same time, and this is what I really like, we were open to, okay, where do we find common ground? And we started with this one word. And the one word is now a professional domain. It's a profession. You're an agilist, right? And this is what I like. And then we got to the values, and we had a lot of talks, and there was in between a visit up the mountain, and I saw guys drinking beers and being in hot tubs and skiing and stuff. And then we worked on the principles. I had to fly back, and we finalized the principles of the manifesto over the email, which was created a tsunami of emails. But we were in close connection at the time. Remember that just a couple of months later, we had 9/11, where we had a roundup. Okay, is everyone there? Checking. I remember this.
Wow.
So it was a great experience. And it's,
yeah, I'm curious, Gary, let me jump in. I'm curious about the process. So you described, you know, 17 people with, you know, their own buckets of intellectual property, and there's that possibility of posturing, but clearly you guys broke through that very quickly, right, through debates and dialogue, and got such an incredibly crystal clear set of four values in that weekend. How did that happen? Can you point to some of the magic, some of the process, that got from such different backgrounds, that were well established to such simple and elegant set of value pairs?
I think you're asking me something I just cannot recall exactly. The thing is,
sure.
When I look at my own personal situation, being involved in at least the DSDM community since 1997, being together, sharing best practices, and create one shared outcome is something that has been, you know, even since 1994 in projects, but also in the community later on, has been part of my mindset, right? So doing this with guys I didn't know, but I respect instantly just for them being there, and they were invited by others of the group, so they must have a track record. I didn't know them. Bear in mind, I didn't know them. And some of them knew each other, which was, okay, we're going to create a manifesto, so they were already sort of aligned. And for me, the alignment process still, you know, when you talk to communities, but also then felt really, you know, that's natural. That's what you do for me.
So, if you don't mind, some of the guys that we've spoken to in the past mentioned an exercise where to kind of harness the various conversations, there was an exercise that everyone kind of wrote some things on index cards and threw those index cards into the center of a circle. And yep. there was an affinity mapping exercise that followed that, where this is kind of like that or that is kind of like this. And that helped steer the conversation. Do you recall that activity?
I remember also with the flip charts on the floor, the flip charts on the stand, and walking around it and trying to bring stuff together. Yep. Yeah.
Do you recall maybe on one of the flip charts or on one of the cards, anything that you had written down that you had contributed and thrown into the pile that kind of sticks out in your mind?
I have to be very honest. What for me has been, but I don't know who wrote what, and I don't want to take any credits from anyone else. But the things that are still very important to me is the value thinking, one of the paradigms in transforming to agile, you know, going away from requirements thinking and moving towards value thinking. And things like maximizing the work not done and trust people to get the job done. They are, for me, so important. Mm-hmm. All also been a big hurdle because no one was, at the time, understanding this. So if you go working with a team and you expect them to be self-organizing, and now I know becoming self-organizing takes time, it was very difficult for the team. So it took, you know, were big hurdles. And that was very important. I know that I talked when we were talking about, you know, is it flexible, is it agile, what's the word? That I knew the agile, the word agile, I knew it from being in the military forces, the anti-tank, American anti-tank plane, A-110 Eagle. You know this one?
Sadly, I do not, but...
Okay, that came to my mind when we talk about this, about, you know, agility. So I remember contribution to that part of documentation. I remember the value thinking for me being very important. And actually, I was in February, I was in Munich on a conference, and I met James Groening and Ward Cunningham. Mm-hmm. And then they were talking software development, very technical stuff. And I, you know, I'm not in the technical stuff anymore. So I most likely sort of, you know, looked very, very... very blurred at them, and James looked at me and he said, "Yeah, Ari, you were always more from the business side, weren't you?" And I think that's the part where I contributed on the value the most. Yeah. Which is important. Yeah.
I just want to share with you. I mean, I'm sure you stay in touch with some of these guys, but it's beautiful to me to hear when you guys talk about the event. I've asked this question a few different ways, a few different times, and almost every single time, nobody wants to take credit for anything individually. You guys form some type of brotherhood or some type of fraternity at that event. And it always defers back to, it was the output of the group, no one individual. So I think that's absolutely amazing that resonates with every one of you guys that I talk to. That's cool.
Can I be honest? I think you can be proud of what you do. And I'm talking, you know, my oldest son was actually, while we were in the cold, just leaving, and he is doing his master's in psychology. And people talk to him about his father, you know, being agile, because agile is about interaction, is about people. It's dominating even the news, the national news here. I am proud of what I've done, and I know I contributed a lot to the community starting in 1994, not just 2001, 1994, but at the same time, I think agile is about understanding that you step away from individual tasking into team delivery and team performance. And if you preach this only for others and not for yourself, you're not an agilist.
Agreed.
I love it. I love it. Wow.
So, sorry, guys, that you don't. Sorry. I stopped.
No. I think it's wonderful. And so it leads me to like a whole nother line of thinking. So when the manifesto was written, you guys clearly chose to say for software development. And over the years, people have applied it outside of IT. And the way you described it is almost role agnostic, right? As long as there's a team of people with skill sets, in theory, this mindset, these values, and these principles would apply. And I think conversations we've had separately with you, you'd agree. So in your mind, you know, if we have this conversation in 15 years from now, which I hope we do, what will we be talking about?
Okay, if I then take you 15 years back first. I started doing Agile outside of the world of IT shortly after writing the Agile Manifesto. Agile is an efficient way of working, taking out a lot of redundant work, and you replace a lot of the redundant remote written work by face-to-face interaction. Agile is an interaction concept. In this world where we live, where technology is developing in such a pace that you have something new every month or every 3 months, really new, all the time, responsiveness to the market as an organization, I'm not talking IT, as an organization, is essential. At this moment in time, so now I'm stepping 15 years from the past to the now, as an organization, you have to be able to respond. Business agility is crucial for survival. Agile makes you future-proof. 15 years from now, the thing we are going to see is that Agile, like the waterfall has been in the past, Agile will be the new way of working. Because if you're not able to solve this, you know, Agile delivers better value in an earlier stage with a better internal quality. If you're not able to do this in the future on the corporate level, and that's sooner than 15 years, I can promise you, you're out of business.
Yeah, you so just won't be here to have the conversation, right?
And this is what it is. So what we do with Humanity. As I said, you know, I didn't much writing books and trademark, but I trademarked the integrated agile transformation model. Because I can see so many, I'm not talking about the new organizations, but existing organizations with a lot of history like banking, energy, they have to, and this is what is going to happen. You know, people have to, and working agile is not difficult. The problem is that the fact that you have to overcome old paradigms. And you have to replace them by the new paradigms. And that's the difficulty, because paradigms define your reflexes under stress. And if a company is under stress and you're not able to step into the world of, you know, agile working and thinking where you have a high responsiveness to what happens, you're out of business. So where already shortly after writing the manifesto, I always replaced on PowerPoint and so on the words software by solutions.
Right. Yeah,
and I think we're going into the next stage. We do corporate transformations already at the moment. We do it in Germany, we do it in Romania, we do it in the Netherlands, we do it in Belgium, we do it in France. We do corporate transformations already.
So you mentioned quite a few times that you were doing some of these transformations remotely, or at least partially remotely. I know a lot of times, especially when you talk to some of the hardcore dogmatists, they want co-located teams. And the reality, at least in my experience, has been that is the exception, not the rule. More often today, we're dealing with distributed teams or virtual teams. How do you feel about doing transformations or creating that agile mindset within enterprises that have that distributed staffing model?
Okay, the first thing I have to say is my coach is the team. And I often join the teams in you know, with management sessions and so on during the transformation waves that we have in our model. But our coaches are on site. They're on site. There's no remote work in the transformation because they have to bring in the new paradigms, which is the most difficult one. And the agile rituals are supported by the paradigms if you want to really do them well. So our coaches are on site. But my client can have people who work across Europe or even wider. And I have to be very honest. When I remember, you know, doing this kind of projects in 1995, 1996, and I would drive with my car up and down the country to get people from the business, meet people from the supplier, really driving up and down. These days, I see guys doing pair programming, and I see network excellent, where people have their daily with three people on one side of the flat screen and four people on another side of the flat screen. They have their daily, they have a shared board on another flat screen that they can lean kit, Kanban, or whatever. And after the daily, they go to their working place, they put on their Skype set, and they start pair programming together, being 3,000 kilometers apart. So on one hand, and I know, face to face, having the non-verbal is so important, right? So that you can see, are people feeling, are they really agreeing, or do they have second thoughts, that kind of thing. Video conferencing, realtor, we're really, really good connections where you have really video. I sometimes joke and I say, well, the only thing that you have is that, you don't smell each other, but the rest is there, right? And it works. The only thing is, it's good to have those people meeting on a regular basis every now and then, especially in the beginning, Agile project foundations, the way I work. During foundations, I try to make people meet, if we have the budget to do so, because being together in the evening after a day of work, having a beer and a wine and food and good talks and jokes and play pool, that is for the team building so important, because if you do so, people later on being geographically distributed and connected via Skype or Hangout or Zoom, they have low access to each other because they know each other, right? And that's for the team. They can open up, they are transparent. If they have an impediment, they will not wait trying to solve it themselves, they will bring it forth. So find a way to have them together for a short while at least to create the first steps in the team. Video conference.
Yeah, I agree with you.
Great mistake.
Yeah, but video, you see from neck up, and as you've described, you don't have the smells, granted, but you don't have the body language, right? And you don't have the context. And I love that you stress that initial in-person, face-to-face,
yes,
to build that connective tissue that carries on through the rest of the project. Do you have a sense for, how often you want to do that? I mean, clearly, once a year is not a good cadence, but and once a week is budgetarily impossible. But, in terms of human needs, what's a good frequency that you've seen for that get together, have a beer?
Yeah, exactly. Let me give you an example. One of the things that I like, when I do projects most likely take somewhere between 1-2 months and maybe 6-8 months, something like this. And maybe for the minimum viable product, it takes you 4-5 months, maybe, say 8 sprints or something. And then you have your first delivery and so on. When I do my project foundations, that's number one. When we do a new project, that would be preferably the next time we meet at least. What if you have an organization where you don't do projects? People do just operations, they handle incidents and they work with teams and they're pairing and refactoring and so on. What I always say is what you can do, because we're talking always here budget, very correct what you said. What I like is that for me, Agile is about also continuous learning, continuous improvement, right? That's very important. So if you have a modus where you have the small communities meet, let's say on a monthly basis, where the Agile project managers and the Agile developers and the Agile business representatives, they have their own sessions, they learn from each other, maybe they make publications, they do extra stuff. The second month they do it again, and the third month the communities organize sessions that other communities can meet, so you have a big knowledge share. That means at least once a quarter people can be together. It costs money, but you don't have just beer and food, but you also have learning. So you create a big learning in the company, and it's the same time you're building the team. It's a very, very nice process. It works.
Yeah, I love it. So what are some other patterns that come to your mind for Agile practitioners, not just in IT, but to improve the propagation, the development, the growth of this kind of mindset? So besides, face-to-face, human contact, what other patterns can you offer?
Well, what I always say in projects, I love the heartbeats. And most people don't know the heartbeat because most people stick to Scrum. But my, if you look at the waterfall, you know, we have this, let's say, the basic step from analysis, functional design, technical design, development, test, QA, pre-production, production, something like this. Hmm. And that's a sequence. And what I do is I turn that sequence 90 degrees. And all the people, you know, from left to right in this process involve the security officer, the legal officer, the marketing communication officer will be there. Everyone who has a say in accepting the requirements when they are delivered. I try to get them together on a weekly basis in an hour to 2 hours heartbeat session. Let's just quick feedback loop on the content of the solution, how it's evolving, new insights, new things happening outside that we take into the process. So you create the bond there. That's in projects so helpful, the heartbeat. It works awesome. It creates a team. People know each other. You get the best value ever. What I like in the communities and what I always ask my people, go to other sessions, go to meetups, go to conferences, connect to people, respond to people on Twitter when they have an opinion, open the debate. And the one and most important thing is it's not a ritual, it's not an interaction, but the precondition for everyone should be open to reflection and self-reflection and improvement. And I see too many people who are really dogmatic and call themselves agile. And when you are dogmatic, you're not agile, period.
Nice.
And managers, if whatever a manager is, or team leads, or teams, should motivate each other to be reflective. And to be reflective means that you need a safe organization to open up and be transparent, right? So that has to be put in place by both managers and the teams. Manager is not a dirty word.
Completely agree. It's you're applying Conway's law of software to the maturity and the safety models of an organization. So, I just want to point out that, you know, for the sake of validity, Ari preaches or practices what he preaches here. I think this actual interview started with you DMing me on Twitter and asking me a question about something on the Agile Uprising. So, it's not just you press your people to make sure that they and that they follow through on things, but you yourself are modeling that at your level. So that's beautiful just to see that go 360.
Yeah, we do it in our company as well. We are agile organized. We have self-organizing teams. It means that you facilitate as an organization, you facilitate your people. At the same time, you're expecting something back from every individual in terms of being open, being learning, self-reflective, and supportive to fellow teammates.
That's great.
And then again, it's taken away from software. It's, you know, we are of course we have technical guys, and I program myself, and I have guys who implement, you know, the pipelines for continuous integration and delivery and the tools. Yeah, they're technical. Yeah. But it's the interaction concept that makes the success and the difference.
Love it.
And only then, if you have this in place, then technology can help you to excel in what you do. Yeah.
That's great. So you touched on scaling earlier, and I think you gave an appetizer of your feelings there. But just in general, that is a big movement. There's two or three big movements going on within the, and I'm doing air quotes here, the brand of Agile. And one of those would be scaling, another one would be the certification. I'm curious what your feelings are on this direction that the Agile community is heading.
You mean the scaling thing or the certification thing?
Both, either, whatever you feel passionate about.
Okay, let me talk about certification in general. I know there are people who are really, you know, against certification, and it's not agile. I don't know where they got this, but okay. I don't mind certification, because if you go to high school, at the end, you certify yourself. If you go into university, at the end, you certify yourself. So that's what we do. And it's just that it's a proof. Yes, you know, this is what I master. Maybe it's theory, maybe it's practice, maybe it's, you know, the ultimate craftsmanship. This is what I master. So I don't mind certification. What I do love in certification programs is the certification programs are organized by non-profit organizations, because certification should never be for profit, because then you certify, then you provide certification for the wrong reasons, in my opinion. And that's my personal opinion, because it's you have a different interest. And if you have a non-profit organization that just provides certification so that you can prove that you are who you say you are, that's fine. If you go to a profit organization, I don't say that profit organizations for certifications are wrong, but at least there is a risk for mixed interests. Right. So this is a little for me. That's my point on.
No, that's good. It's actually giving me something to think about. I'm not sure. I teeter on the fence. Obviously, I have my own certifications. Andy has his own certifications. And you're making a compelling argument.
Yeah, so it's not about blaming. It's about there is a risk, and I see organizations that organize certification to make money, and not to say, okay, now you can prove, because that's the other thing, you know. There's so many people out there who call themselves an agile coach. And I was actually, a couple of weeks ago, I was in a large organization in my country talking to an agile coach. And this agile coach, I asked, do you work agile yourself? The answer was no, because no, we don't need to work agile ourselves. Oh, that's cool. Then I asked, okay, now, what's your agile method, you know, that you prefer? And then she looked with her glazing eyes, because she didn't know there were more agile methods than Scrum. And if this person is an agile coach, you know, it really beeps me off if this happens, if you can understand what I mean.
Yes.
Because the work from the guys from Extreme Programming is so important. If you work in an IT delivery company, it's, we are working agile, absolutely brilliant. And you cannot do without. Agile PM, Lean and Kanban working, they're brilliant. All right, and more. And just the fact that you call yourself an agilist and you're not even looking outside what you know is horrifying. So there I have an issue, right? And then I asked the same coach, okay, if you don't know any other agile method, what's your favorite agile practice? And I got the same glazing eyes. I thought, oh my God. So this is a big of the issue. So I, you know, we are, agile has become so big that, you know, companies want to become agile, so you need people to help them to become agile. I can see that happening from my project teams, you know, 20, 30 people on the average, you know, in the beginning of my agile career. So multi-team scaling, yeah, the other question that you asked. For me, working multi-team agile has been the standard. And I think in hindsight, maybe this is why writing the Agile Manifesto, most of the others said, you know, your way of working is so big. But if I have five or six teams working in parallel, I cannot stick to a team thing. I have to do something to make that connected. Right? Yeah. And it's there. And that's not just me. Remember this. It was a whole community in the UK, continental Europe, Scandinavia at that time, working and contributing to that agile practice. So it wasn't new, right. And it was really well used at the time.
I'm curious, I've had some other conversations with people in our group about how big something can scale. And one of the concepts that came up was Dunbar's number, you know, that sort of fuzzy number of, you know, 150 people is about all the relationships you can keep in your head. And so as you're scaling with these teams and you're doing DSDM and humanity, do you hit sort of a limit of size that you see as a functional constraint?
No. For me, it's the interaction concept with those you are relating to in your work, where you have a dependency or a connection. This is where integrated agile helps you. And we have companies, we have an energy provider compared to the US market, might be a small one. It's about 600 people. They are fully transformed into agile. We work in 3-month waves. We are in wave 3 and they are there. We're just helping them, you know, to refine the last bits and pieces. They do an awesome job. We have an 800 people organization in Central Europe. Full organization is transferring. It's just one of the things that's really for me, very helpful is that you have to feel, and this is what I like in for example, SAFe as well, that you scale up. It's okay, let's see where we have connections. So, for example, let me go back to the energy provider here in the Netherlands. They have a management team, and they work in a part of the building. In that part of the building, in the hallway, there is an integrated agile wall. Information radiators are key. Step away from the paradigm that documentation is the same as MS Word. Documentation is easy, accessible information that is up to date and maintainable. And the moment you have it on the wall, everyone can work it. Everyone has the latest version, so we all know what we talk about. So you can do this on the full organization portfolio level. And then you can derive it back to teams, and they have their own smaller. They look the same, but they have just more detailed scale up to user stories, if you like. So there is no limit to this.
Yeah, it's fractal then. What I hear you saying is it's sort of a fractal pattern that just keeps scaling out.
Yes, it is. Yeah. And it is supported by things that I know not everyone does, because I see so many people who work in an agile way, working still with documents, Word. And I always try to get my clients away from Word when possible. I know sometimes you need Word documentation, that's fine. But information radiators on the wall for the process, for things like planning and burn down, we know them all. They work brilliantly, but also for functional architecture, technical architecture, data models, screen flows, whatever, system documentation on the wall. And the moment you have this, it's easy, accessible, readable for everyone. And then you create better ways of sharing. Well, I think knowledge sharing is the magic word here.
Yeah, it's visual.
And then it's as you said, you know, you can do it. We do it across corporates. That's what corporations, that's what we do.
Yeah. This has just been a fantastic conversation. We should go on for forever. I know you have a hard constraint, so I want to kind of wrap it up. I'll give you one last question, and then a few minutes if there's some things that you want to tell us about what you're working on. If you could give us, you know, if sort of the 30-second in the elevator, you see an agilista coming out of some conference and they bump into you. What advice? What words of wisdom? What challenge would you give? What would you like to see this younger generations of agilists do to continue the legacy that came out of that magic weekend in Snowbird 15 years ago?
Oh, okay, now I have to find an answer, right, to that question. what I would suggest to everyone, old and young, new or experienced in the agile world. In agile working, old paradigms are tracking you back to remote and written communication and silos for work. And we want to work end-to-end, and we want to work face-to-face and that kind of stuff. Overcoming the paradigms is the most difficult one. The signal, raising the flag of bumping into an old paradigm, is when you say, yes, but. And the moment that you say yourself, yes, but, look in the mirror. It's okay. It actually listen. Just to tell the other guy he's wrong, or did I listen to understand?
That's great. So, Ari, is there anything you want to direct anyone that may be listening to, your Twitter, your blog, your website, a conference you have upcoming, or anything?
Yeah, well, I love it when people connect to me on LinkedIn. I love it when people connect to me on Twitter, so please do so. I love this. I love it when they come to conferences. Most of my conferences, as you can imagine, are in Europe, just for travel reasons. Just follow me on Twitter and LinkedIn, and then you'll know. And I love to have conversations. I love to meet people in trainings and sessions and so on. So it's about, you know, getting you know, the connection. That's for me the most. So LinkedIn, Twitter. Just find my name and Google me, or LinkedIn search, Twitter search, and you'll get me.
There are very few Ari Van Bennekoms on the social network, so you're pretty easy to find.
Yeah, at the moment you type my name, most of the time I'm the first one that you get back.
So. And you, from personal experience, you don't even have to have the spelling of Bennekom nailed. You just got to get close and it's still
That's okay, good to know. Good to know. Yeah.
So thank you very much, Ari. I appreciate you taking the time with us. This was a great conversation. I always appreciate the European perspective, and you're such a great resource. And I hope you understand how much Andy and I appreciate you taking this time with us today.
Well, sure. Ryan and Andy, for the both of you, I want to thank you for your time. I love having these kind of talks. I love people like you guys, you know, spreading the word and through your own community, get it out there. So thank you from my side to you.
Thank you.
This episode of the Agile Uprising podcast is brought to you by VGroup Digital. VGroup Digital provides native cloud-based software development services on iOS, Android, web, Mac, and Windows, as well as enterprise product development, maintenance, and support. VGroup Digital is led by a team of agile practitioners who believe in collaboration, constant feedback, and delivering the highest value at all times. Visit www.vgroupdigital.com for more info and mention the Agile Uprising podcast to get up to 15% off all development services.
At JCPenney, we make fashion count for everybody and everybody. Get pieces that fit and flatter at prices that feel good. Mix easy on cargos with breezy tops or polish your look with soft suiting. Step into JCPenney brands that get you, like St. John's Bay and Worthington, each in women's petite and plus sizes too. Guys, you're good to go in brands like Mutual Weave, J. Farrar, and Stafford. Style and comfort for all, even big and tall. Here, spring comes in all shapes, sizes, and colors. JCPenney, make everybody count.
When you drive a vehicle so reliable it's backed by a 10-year, 100,000-mile limited warranty, you stop thinking about what you can't do and start doing what you never thought possible. Visit your local Kia dealer today to see what you're capable of in a vehicle that inspires confidence around every corner. Kia. Movement that inspires.
Call 800-333-4KIA for details. Always drive safely. Limited inventory available. Warranties include 10-year, 100,000-mile powertrain and 5-year, 60,000-mile basic. Warranties are limited. See retailer for details.